Hello, and welcome back to Millennial 2021. Sorry about the delay. There were some technical problems. These things happen. I'm now here, and this is one that I've been looking forward to quite a lot. I'm now here with Dan from The Fergan. Now, The Fergan is a Telegram channel and an Odyssey channel. I think it's on YouTube as well, is it? I don't know.
Yeah, it is, yeah.
Right, okay. And Dan, would you like to introduce yourself?
Yeah, okay. I mean, I just want to say, even if I were mad about the Woodlander being a bit overly long, I couldn't be because of it was such a great show, that one. Really enjoyed that. So, if you're out there, Woodlander, listening, well done. I think he's holding the key, as far as I'm concerned, to what everyone needs to be aiming for. But I'm sure we'll get into that later. My name's Dan. I'm a musician, a heathen. I've long been a proponent of identity and tradition, and I suppose I'll make a bit of a revelation now, if that's all right, Colin. This will probably be of interest to a few of you. Probably be quite inconsequential to most of you, but I also go by the name Steed, and have done for many years. We, Colin and I, did actually speak last year for the Crypto for Nationalists show, so it's good to speak to you again. And yes, I also set up a Telegram channel called The Fergan, a YouTube and Odyssey channel, which have got a few videos on each. And I've really just been driven to speak as kind of forcefully as I can about the current tyranny which is gripping the world.
And there's also your musical projects that you wanted to mention.
Just because I know that there'll be a few people who are interested. I have my main musical project is called Walkensman, and some of you might know my music from Survive the Jive's intro. The music he uses for the intro for his videos for the last however many years has been a song that I wrote and recorded called Sunnah. So that's the kind of music I make with that project. It's kind of like a dark heathen folk kind of neoclassical affair, really. I've also got quite a long history playing in various bands, working in the music industry, touring, working as a designer for lots of bands. That's pretty much kind of my musical background in a nutshell.
See, you're a good example, and actually the Woodlander is similar. You're a good example of a creative person who has unconventional religious or spiritual beliefs and is now involved in the dissident right. Now, obviously, I don't really even know what that term means at this point. So, you know, I'm not roping you into any particular beliefs. I think you're not political. You're not really a nationalist in that sense, but you're a fellow traveller. What would you say about that?
I would say, and actually, I've been listening to a few of your millennial streams, and you've been echoing my current sentiments quite a lot in how you express that you've lost interest in politics, and the same goes for me to a large extent. I've been sceptical of the electoral system for many years, since Trump came in, when Trump was first kind of coming on the scene, I was very sceptical of him, and I never supported him. I never thought that he would do anything. So for quite a long time, I've been, some people would consider it kind of black-pilled on politics, but to me, you know, understanding that that's a dead end gives me more hope because we can focus our efforts elsewhere. So I'd absolutely 100% consider myself a dissident. I've never considered myself right wing or left wing. Not out of any kind of pragmatic reasons or any particular dislike for those who do consider themselves part of that, but just because I've never really liked to kind of pigeonhole myself in a way which I believe our opponents want us to, particularly those at the very top. You know, I do believe that there is this left-right dichotomy, which has pretty much always been well, certainly for the last couple of decades, has been a trap in my view. So yeah, I'm a dissident for sure. I don't know about dissident right, but you know, I'm not going to quibble about it.
Yeah, God, there are so many things we could go into there about the left and the right. As for my own thing about being disillusioned with politics, it's not so much that I am disillusioned. What sane person would not be disillusioned with politics at this stage? Well, unless you were a communist or whatever, but even then, they could have complaints. It's not so much that I'm disillusioned, though. It's more that and I've said it for years. I remember saying it in 2017 that I've said everything I have to say about race and the whole identity thing starts to be a bit boring. And in that sense, it was a sort of a new lease of life for me when the COVID disaster started, because it was a new thing to analyze, a new thing to ponder over and talk about. And then swiftly following COVID was the Great Reset, which we still don't, it still hasn't really been defined. I mean, it's nearly 2 years, well, a year and a half on now. And we're still waiting for that. We're still wondering what that will entail. I think you'll be going into that later on in this stream, to some extent at least. So this is all new to me, and it's far more interesting and far more pertinent. And I was saying this, as I say, 4 or 5 years ago, but also earlier this year. So it sort of saddened me that Philosophicat's stream the other night got a bad rate. I think it was, she could have articulated it better, but you know, I am sympathetic with what she said, and I was saying similar stuff earlier this year on my own weekly show. But either way, we don't need to get into my views. I'd like to hear your summary, because last time you were on talking about crypto, and we kept it very focused on that. So could you give me your account of COVID, the last year and a half, what your observations of what has happened over the last year, and then we'll get on to why that has happened, and what the long-term agenda is. So yeah, sure. COVID.
So, yeah, like yourself, I was rejuvenated by this whole manufactured crisis, and I am grateful to it. You know, it's something that I've talked about on my Telegram channel quite a bit. It's, you know, my big awakening was 9/11, and this is the biggest thing that's happened since 9/11. It's the biggest wake up call to people to realize how the world really works, how politics really works since 9/11. So, you know, and this goes back to why I'd previously been active under the name Steed, because for many years I had a passion for lots of the subjects which are being talked about in dissident circles, but I didn't feel like I needed to get involved to that level where I needed to put my name and my face out there. But when COVID hit, instantly I knew that I had to put myself out there, especially because in the early days there was such a poor response from many sort of dissident circles. So I kind of put myself on the line, really, and something that I've come to realize just recently in the last few days, really, that how I would describe what's happened over the last 20 months is a top-down global revolution. You know, I mean, any revolution that happens throughout history, almost any revolution that happens behind, throughout history. I know Mark Malone said that the American Revolution he thought was the only genuine revolution, and I don't know if he's right in that or not. I'm sure there are others, but most revolutions that occur don't actually occur for the reasons that the history books tell us that they occur, and what they're really about, as I'm sure many people realize, is regime change. And that's exactly what this is.
It's one elite supplanting another elite. And even as it's happening, it's not happening for the reasons that, you know, even as it's happening, the false narrative is installed. So, you know, you can see that now, that we have to rebalance our economy so that there's more equality. I mean, it's not... Anyway, we can get into that. Sorry, I interrupted.
Yeah, but that's okay. But this time it's on a global scale, which is why I think that this is so significant. And I still don't think a lot of people are grasping how enormous this is. The fact that this is this global revolution, which is occurring in every country simultaneously. You know, there's no country being left out. I mean, people talk about Sweden and Belarus and things, but I think it's only, well, it's certainly only a matter of time. Any country which seems to be a little bit behind in the agenda, it's only a matter of time before it's brought into lockstep. To use a pun referencing the Rockefeller paper from 2010. It's a global revolution. But this time it's not. Well, it is about regime change in the sense that I believe we're moving away from parliamentary democracy, from national governments to a form of international governance, global governance. All of our previously held values and our customs and our laws are being toppled. I can't remember which stream it was, but I did watch one of your streams the other night where someone talked about how it's like everything's been, you know, the game board has been thrown off the table and all the pieces have been scattered across the floor.
Was Mark Malone.
Was it? Yeah.
I think it might.
Yeah, whoever said that, if it was Mark or someone else, I think that's a perfect description, and that's why we're all finding ourselves in this this kind of confounding chaos, where even those of us who've got our finger on the pulse still don't really know where to turn. We don't know, you know, what to believe, where to look, as hard as we might try. It's because there's been this deliberate state of chaos and confusion brought across the world. So yeah, it's a top-down revolution.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right that people don't... A lot of people, I think, and this is a criticism that I'm going to make of a lot of nationalists, I think they want it to be basically the situation of a few years ago still. They want to return to that because that was understandable. Mm-hmm. Okay, there are globalists and there are nationalists and the nationalists have got to get control of the national government and we can do that, and that's that. I think already the situation, you know, COVID shows that already that situation is gone. There is already global governance. There is already a network, a system of control. I mean, you saw what they did. You saw how easy it was, how effortless it was for them. It was just astonishing. They've got the population of the West in a state of fear, very rapidly, and there's the media are that, you know, there's no objection, there's no counter to that narrative being presented. Whereas only 20 years ago, there would have been there definitely would have been in the 90s. So everything is harmonized, and I don't know when this happened. I don't know when it started, when it was completed, but definitely in time for March 2020, it was completed. And you've got every museum, every NGO, every academic department, every corporation, all of them are in lockstep. Yeah. All of them are in agreement. It's remarkable.
Yeah, well, I see it as validation, which is one of the things that I find so kind of positive about the whole thing. For people like myself and, you know, probably to an extent yourself and others who've been on Millennial and, other, you know, plenty of those listening, for years and years, we've either known kind of instinctively or intellectually that there is this, for to use a term that everyone is familiar with, this new world order in the shadows, this kind of global network who are working towards a singular agenda for global control. But it's been largely theoretical. It's been largely kind of you know, we could only speculate on what was really going on there. But what's happened here is that they've laid their cards out on the table. And just because the majority of people haven't seen those cards and realised that they're there on the table, we can see them now. So we can be emboldened and confident now that what we suspected for many years is absolutely true, and that there is nothing for it but to act in well, I don't want to say response, because I think it's dangerous if we get into the habit of acting, if always reacting to what they're doing. But certainly we know that we need to act in some manner now, and that this isn't just speculation anymore.
Absolutely. And you've now got Klaus Schwab just seeing the things that are incredible, like, you know, the World Economic Forum video, "You will own nothing and be happy." This is now an infamous phrase. Everyone's heard it many times. And they're talking about digital ID. They're talking about digital government, centralized cryptocurrency. They're talking about surveillance of a level that would have made your eyes water 20 years ago. I think Klaus Schwab even talked about monitoring people's thoughts. He said, just a throwaway comment. And that's the thing, it was a throwaway comment. It was not a serious speech at a serious conference about that one topic. It was just a throwaway comment.
I recall that now, yeah.
Absolutely incredible. And this is the kind of thing that, because people haven't seen a huge event, a huge announcement about something like that, if you say it, you sound like a paranoid conspiracy theorist. That's what they'll say. But no, he said it. It is real. It is true. He actually said that. And he is in a position to know these things, and to be advising other movers and shakers to go down that direction. So when he says it, even as a throwaway comment, especially when he says it as a throwaway comment, you should take it very seriously.
Yeah.
So this change, I think you're right that it vindicates a lot of the more paranoid, you know, the people who use. I mean, this is the thing, the people who used to get pilloried as tinfoil hat wearers and whatever. What at this stage? What have they been wrong about? There clearly is a move for towards a highly controlled society, and so let's speak more about how COVID represents that. I suppose you've seen the manufacturing of public opinion, the drowning out of any sort of opposition to that. You've seen these bizarre, different narratives being implanted. And introduce a concept will be introduced as a possibility or just a hypothetical or something that will not be necessary. But then by saying that, you're introducing the concept into the public discourse, into the public consciousness. And then 6 months later, you say, maybe it will, maybe that should happen. And then 6 months later, of course, that's got to happen. And then 6 months later, it's happening.
Yeah. And here's a little bit of a kind of dark take on that, which I've been wrestling with a bit myself over the last, well, most of the time that this has been going on, which is that have we who follow and perpetuate alternative media contributed to that? You know, like I think about, you know, going back to last March and April, myself and friends were sharing, you know, you'd see images of, I think it was MasterCard had like big billboards on, you know, in the London subway saying that your bank balance would be tied to your digital identity and things. And, you know, that goes back to the 2016 UN summit on ID 2020. So they've been talking about digital ID for years. And because this, you know, this manufactured crisis happened, all of a sudden people like us dissidents, we're focused on it and we're sharing around the this proof that it's happening and that it's going to happen. And I can't help wondering whether we're helping to seed these ideas among our side. That's not to say that we shouldn't have done it, that we shouldn't have brought it to people's attention, but it's only something I can kind of wonder about at this point. But Yeah, I mean, all of it's been foreshadowed. I mean, I just saw today someone sent me a link to a Daily Mail article where Tony Blair was talking about how COVID had given them additional reasons to bring in a digital ID. So he's admitting there that COVID wasn't the sole reason that they're pushing digital IDs.
Oh,
it was an additional reason.
You and I are about the same age, I think, so... Mm-hmm. I can remember in 2004, 2005, 2006, the Labour Party, New Labour, were really big on identity cards. They really wanted to bring this in. I remember the Home Secretary, Jackie Smith. She was there's a famous publicity shot of her at some conference holding up her identity card, and she's willingly doing it. She's happy with it. Everyone else should be happy with it as well, and. Everyone hated the idea, and this is a depressing reflection on how the population have changed in the last 15 or 20 years. At that time, everyone was horrified by the idea, because I remember people saying, this is un-British. Mm. It's like to be expected to carry an identity card around wherever you go. Of course, the globalists have an answer for that as well. You won't have to carry it around. But anyway, it's un-British. There's no need for it. It's Orwellian, it's Nazi, it's totalitarian. We don't do things like that in Britain. But, you know, Boris said we don't do mandatory vaccinations. We don't do things like that in Britain. He said that less than a year ago. And now, you know, we'll have to look into that.
Yeah, well, Parliament voted just before Christmas 2020 against the prospect of vaccine passports. So, and that was very quickly kind of overcome, I guess, by, you know, variants and surges and scaremongering in the media. And now here we are. I mean, yeah, that No to ID campaign that you're talking about in the early 2000s, I was an active part of that. I had a huge pile of stickers, which I had, you know, stuck in my car, and I'd stick around the place. And that was... That was a threat that was very easily overcome in hindsight. You know, there was an opposition to it, but that opposition didn't have to do much more than, you know, put up a few stickers around the place. And I think, you know, my background in understanding that they wanted to do it then is one of the reasons why I knew immediately when COVID hit what it was really about, and why it was so frustrating to see, you know, so-called dissidents who were they were mocking people like me. They were calling us you know, boomer conspiracy theorists and libertarians and liberals and all of this, because we didn't want to give all of our power to the state. We didn't want to let the state exercise maximum force, essentially. But the problem is, when you understand that for years, if not decades, I mean, you know, Agenda 21, which I'm sure, you know, we'll get into, that was signed on to in 1992. So that's nearly 30 years ago. So at least for that long, they've had this agenda, and they've just been looking for the right way to get it through, to get it past the public. They didn't manage it in the early 2000s by just merely suggesting a national ID scheme. They needed something which was going to force people's you know, mentality to accept that.
Absolutely. In retrospect, just a sort of side point, in retrospect, I think you can see, because, you know, a lot of people are surprised. I am surprised by what's happened over the last 2 years. I won't pretend to have predicted this or seen it coming. I didn't. Mm. There were hints here and there, of course, but I didn't know that it was just around the corner, for sure. But in retrospect, looking at New Labour, you can see a sort of foreshadowing of all this. You can see that they were the first government the first Labour government that jettisoned the old Labour values, the old Labour concerns, you know, the working class. They didn't give a shit. They couldn't have cared less about the working class. I mean, in fact, I think they actively despised the working class. I mean, why else would you flood these ex-industrial towns with unassimilable, you know, whatever? And now, you know, you've got the awful, hellish results of that. But anyway, there are certain characteristics of New Labour that fit, and this is 22 years ago, 1997, 24 years ago now. There are several characteristics that fit directly into the COVID agenda today. So they're friendly to big capital. They're authoritarian. They are corrupt. I mean, they're and pragmatic. They do whatever works. They're not very ideological, really. It's all about power. It's all about control. Friendly to big capital. And the freedom, the individual freedom of the citizen, is really just the freedom to be a consumer. It's the freedom to choose between products. And that is all the identity that they wanted people to have. I mean, they didn't care about English identity, Scottish identity, even though they were pro-devolution for Scotland. That was not for good reasons. It was not for healthy reasons. They didn't care about any of it, like religion, nothing. It was just, in a sense, nihilistic. I would say, yeah, nihilistic. The only thing they really cared about was economic processes. I think economics came first. But that is because they were plugged into the notion of power processes, which rely on economics. And as for ordinary people, I think that Tony Blair and his ilk probably view ordinary people as little better than bacteria, as Klaus Schwab does, I think, and Bill Gates.
And this is why we should be under no illusion that they genuinely care about the ecology of the planet, the environment. That's all a smokescreen for. It's another vehicle for them to push through this agenda of control. It seems like such an obvious point to make, but they can't just come out and say, you know, right, that's it. You've got too much freedom. We want to take some of that away from you. They can't do that. They always need to find some kind of justification, some kind of excuse. That's what the environmental, Extinction Rebellion thing is all about. That's 100% what COVID is about. And it's frustrating that, you know, we're kind of, even dissidents are always playing catch up. It's like, you know, you said that Labour had betrayed the working class. And I mean, that happened so long ago, and it's so obvious, especially in hindsight, that they've had nothing but scorn for the true, you know, working class of Britain. But it's only in the only when we got to the Brexit vote did we see any actual kind of sign of a real backlash, and then there was the general election after that, wasn't there, where even, you know, lots of the working class, you know, heartlands in the north switched over to the Conservatives. But it took so long, and you know, it's frustrating. And in the same way, we're seeing dissidents now who are even, I mean, I saw an article on Countercurrents today, which is a recent article, even 20 months after the beginning of this entire scam, there are still self-proclaimed dissidents and nationalists who are not just excusing and apologising for the way that the establishment has handled this, but actually calling for them to take a firmer stance on it, to quash what's any kind of threat of this so-called pandemic with a stronger fist still.
Yeah, I was quite astonished by that article. I read the one that you're talking about. I guess that the idea is to present, because I know that a lot of articles have been published on there by people of our mind about the COVID issue. So I think the idea is probably just to present a range of views, just to give them some airtime. But clearly, it was a strange article, especially now. You know, I could understand it March 2020, but not now.
I'm all for seeing different sides of the story, and I'm also the kind of person that likes to kind of hear other people's take on things and try and see things from their point of view. But at this point, I can only see that as dangerous, to be honest. You know, when you've got dissidents and nationalists who are actually telling people to go out and get the jabs, get the booster, telling people to use this papers, please, digital ID, I can't, you know.
Yeah. I know, and it was astonishing. What I would say is that article got brutalized in the comments. If you look at the comments underneath
it. Oh, I didn't see them.
Yeah, including okay. including from other Countercurrents writers.
Good.
it was good. I mean, so in that sense, it's actually quite good because it's an exercise in, okay, here are these ideas and here's the response to those ideas. So in that sense, it was actually quite useful for us.
Okay, I'm glad to hear that.
Yeah. But yeah, I know what you mean. And I mean, I would never say to anyone, yeah, you should get the vaccine. I have said not everyone is going to have much freedom. Some people are going to have to, I think, if they want to maintain their career, if they want to maintain their family, if they want to maintain their house in the way. And that's a choice that some people are going to make inevitably. Mm. And so I'm acknowledging that. But I do think that if you can avoid it, then you should avoid it because God mm-hmm. knows what's, and this is the thing we could actually talk. This is something that actually hasn't come up in millennials so far. And I did a Telegram post about it. I'd be interested. We could maybe just spend 10 minutes going through this because the vaccine, you know, what is the purpose of the vaccine? Now, obviously there is a danger of going into hardcore conspiracy theory territory here, but you know, why not? When you've got globalist oligarchs saying that the wild stuff that they're saying, I think maybe it's time to be a bit more open-minded.
let me
get this thing, because obviously not everyone is
absolutely. I mean, I think we have to be open-minded, and but we also have to be very critical of and careful not to automatically believe anything that's put in front of us on Telegram, but we do have to be open to almost any possibility at this point.
Absolutely. Now I did one post where I talked about the different reasons for the vaccine, and it was like, why do they, because they are clearly obsessed with getting everyone to take the vaccine.
Yeah.
And you know, and I have to say that in itself is suspicious to me, because it's clearly not for the reason that they say it is. It's not to protect you against COVID, because it doesn't really protect you against COVID. It's pathetic in its ability to protect you against COVID compared to other vaccines and like equivalent vaccines for other diseases. And also, COVID itself is simply not a big threat. It's simply not. The death rate, as far as I can tell, the overall death rate is 0.4%. If you're under 80, it's much less than that. It's minuscule. So this vaccine, why are they desperate for everyone to take the vaccine? And, I mean, what... There are two posts that I've written that we could talk about, but I'm trying to find the one where I specifically went into that, and I can't see it. Here's what I wrote in one post about the vaccine. It's primarily psychological. Getting the vaccine makes you feel that you are on board, that you are invested in the narrative, and that you are touched by big pharma, touched in inverted commas, and by the powers that be, that you have received their blessing. So it's a pseudo-religious thing. It also places you officially on one side, with the unvaccinated being on the other side. People that you can judge and despise. And of course, there is a certain clearly the masses feel a certain pleasure in being able to hate. I mean, that's a cliche on the left, but it's true. People do love something to hate. And, you know, this is Orwell's 2-minute hate in 1984.
A common enemy, yeah.
Yeah. So whether or not the vaccine changes you physically, these psychological effects are surely there and very relevant. So what would you say, Dan, about why are, and they clearly are desperate for everyone to take the vaccine. They're, you know, I don't need to illustrate that. So what would you say about that?
Well, the one explanation which I'm completely sure of, and I would stake my entire reputation on, is that it is the pathway to the digital ID. There needs to be something which the digital ID itself proves, otherwise they can't justify enforcing a digital ID. So
yeah, they were back in 2005 with Neil Labour's failed attempt. Then
yeah, I mean they had no, there was nothing there to sell it to the public. But now there's a reason that you need an ID, and because most people believe that this is an act of God, so to speak, as opposed to a fabricated crisis. People are accepting that, you know, what people who would have been opposed completely, entirely to the idea of any kind of papers, police society, any form of digital ID, are now completely on board. And I know several people like that, because they believe that this is a genuine threat which the government is merely responding to in the best way that they can. And they won't hear anything about the fact that, you know, the UN had a plan for digital IDs in 2016, or that, you know, a Rockefeller paper from 2010 was talking about it, or that this all goes back much further. They won't hear any of that. So that's something I'm completely certain of. And that in itself, as far as I'm concerned, is enough of an explanation. Anything beyond that is speculation. It's kind of, you know, at best it's kind of fun, at worst it's kind of a bit crackpot. But I mean, there were lots of ideas that I have entertained. I mean, I looked into I did watch the video of that German, he was an expert on carbon materials, and he put forth a presentation that the vaccine contains graphene hydroxide, which is essentially like minute blades which are just one atom thick and so many atoms long and wide, and that essentially if that gets into your bloodstream, it's going to tear you up from the inside. And he believes that this is why we're seeing so many sportsmen and women you know, passing out on the field, because if this vaccine has got into their bloodstream and they've got an elevated heart rate, then they've got these tiny minute, you know, blades running around their blood vessels. I don't know about that, but again, I can't rule it out because I'm not an expert. You know, I mean, most of us who speculate on this aren't experts, so we can't, you know, whereas I think, a couple of years ago, if someone were to tell you that, you would be justified in saying, well, that's a bit far-fetched. But now with everything that's happened and everything that we're seeing, I mean, can we really rule that out? I don't think we can.
No, I mean, one way to look at it is what would be advantageous for the powers that be. Now, mm-hmm. I don't think that it would be advantageous for them to kill vast numbers of people at once. That, because, well, then again, I don't know. Maybe it would be, but it seems more likely to me that this is something. It could be an undesired, unforeseen side effect. The blood clots and all this, or it could be that they want a slow cull of people so that over, and that, you know, this is the other thing about the vaccine that's not often pointed out, that it clearly wears off from their point of view. As far as they're concerned, it wears off after about 6 months or less. That's why they want you to have it every 6 months. Or it's back to psychological reasons. They want you to keep feeling invested in the narrative. But I don't know. I don't think that's working, because I think that people already are resisting the boosters. So, but anyway, sorry, you go.
Well, they are, but we haven't seen, particularly in England and more widely Britain, we haven't seen them really start to tighten the screw yet. I mean, in France, there was a general scepticism of the vaccines until they said, right, you can't go into supermarkets or restaurants until you can show that you've had your vaccines and boosters. And then apparently there was this surge of people lining up to get their latest jabs. I think, sadly, that's probably what we're going to see here, because we haven't seen that sort of pressure yet. I mean, the other thing is that I do think it is mostly psychological, as you describe. It's probably the simplest way I could put it is that it's cattle branding. You know, these technocrats, that they view us as cattle. They we are here for them to control. They're smarter than us, so they believe. Therefore, they have the right to control us. That's their view.
or so even they see the us moral as, duty to control us.
Absolutely, yeah, because, I mean, you know, and this gets into something I think Mark Malone was talking about, that they believe that nature is deficient. Nature's order is deficient. They believe that they can improve upon that, upon the natural order. I do believe that it's a form of cattle branding, and that they're insulted by the fact that a significant number of us are unwilling to step inside that, you know, whatever you call a pen where cows are branded, you know, that we're not willing to do that. Or as Morgoth described it, you know, get into the lobster pot. I think, you know, you mentioned why do they want every last one of us to be jabbed. And I think this is something that Morgoth and others have been talking about as well, is that if we're not all jabbed and there is a danger, there is a threat coming from this substance, then it will be too obvious that the control group, so to speak, are relatively unscathed, and the test subjects are falling over left, right, and center. So I think if that's true, if there is something harmful to the vaccine, then it's very important to them that within a certain amount of time they get pretty much every last person jabbed. Otherwise, there's going to be comparisons. It will become too obvious what they've done. I'm wary about that as well. I think it would be too obvious. Even if they did manage to get all of us jabbed, I think it would be too obvious that there's this kind of this obvious biological weapon that they've used to do that. I think it's more likely that it could affect fertility, so that it's kind of a slower, decreasing of the population, which is something that we know, according to Agenda 21, the Georgia Guidestones, various other things that they want to achieve. They want to decimate the population, if not more than decimate it.
The famous quote from Bill Gates as well, that,
yeah,
you know, about depopulation via vaccines. It couldn't really be much more clear than that. That's three words, you know?
No.
About the control group, that is the other thing. As long as there is a sizable group remaining who have not had the vaccine, then any effects that commonly strike those who have had it, it will be obvious. That contrast will be obvious. So obviously they would want people, everyone, as quickly as possible to get it. But then, of course, on top of that, it's not that you just have one dose or the two doses. It's they want you to have more and more and more of it. And I think it is pretty much confirmed at this point that it does, that the ovaries and the testes are affected by the spike proteins, that they cluster in those areas. Forgive me if I've just broadcast medical disinformation. I'm pretty sure this is a confirmed fact at this point.
It's certainly being widely reported that way. So by quite reliable sources.
Yeah. So it is ominous. I'm not sure what to say about that. I think you only have to look at the people involved and see. This is the thing. It's the same with climate change. At a certain point, you just have to go by gut instinct, because none of us are going to gather all of the medical knowledge that would be necessary to have a full comprehensive view of all these issues.
No.
It's massively complex with climate change and now with this. And there is so much misinformation and there is so much lack of information as well. I mean, they don't have the testing that you would think they would have done about how does it affect fertility. Doesn't seem to have been done. There is a bizarre, not so bizarre, obviously, lack of interest in the side effects of the vaccine. So they'll just say, there's no evidence that it does X. We haven't looked for any evidence that it does X, but there isn't any. So it's very difficult. So therefore, I think each of us just, in the end, has to go by gut instinct. And this is how you get the midwit meme becomes relevant here, where you've got the tedious the guy who thinks he's much smarter than he is, who goes by, he ignores his instincts, he ignores his gut instinct, and is in love with the idea that he has found the truth in a Guardian article. The Guardian has enlightened him. Well, on either side of him, there are people saying, now, hold on, this just doesn't feel right. This really just doesn't feel right. There's something weird about Klaus Schwab. There's something weird about Bill Gates, etc.
Our gut instinct is a valuable evolutionary tool. I mean, we wouldn't be where we are as a species without it. So when people dismiss it,
I'll just say as an anecdote, my gut instinct has always been correct, with one single exception. There was only one time when it was wrong. Whenever I thought that person's bad news, it's always turned out that in the end, I've usually given them a chance. Foolishly, sometimes I've given them multiple chances. Tried to kid myself about them, and then eventually it just becomes inescapable that that original bad feeling I had was absolutely correct. Yeah. And so gut instinct, certainly in my own case, and I'm not claiming to be clairvoyant or whatever, but I think it is highly attuned. I mean, it's as you say, it's an evolutionary defense mechanism that has developed, and it's extremely accurate.
But in our modern rational world, it's looked down upon, it's discarded as this kind of this kind of irrelevant piece of our past. But I think we would do well to take more note of it, generally speaking. I know there's probably mixed feelings on David Icke, but one thing that he said, which I think is very important, is if you know the destination, then you'll understand the journey. And when you know what the agenda at play is, then everything that we're experiencing makes perfect sense. I mean, of course, the kind of the vaguer aspects of what exactly the vaccine does to us, whether it's harmful stuff. You know, we don't have the answers to that, but we do know, at the very least, as I said, that it does play into this this surveillance system that they're building. The only other thing that I would say about the vaccine, the only other speculation I would make and mention, and this is more for kind of out of curiosity than anything, something to bear in mind, is that when you look at the legal system, it's based completely on technicalities. I mean, down to the most minute details of how words are spoken in a courtroom and things like that. We know this vaccine is an mRNA vaccine, so it does, there's a dispute about whether it alters you genetically or not. As far as I understand it, any tampering with your DNA or RNA is technically genetic alteration. So it's, I think calling it gene therapy is justified.
I keep interrupting you.
It's okay.
But there is a clip that came out about a week ago, 2 weeks ago, of one of these globalist oligarchs saying that it is gene therapy.
It's so, rewriting the genetic code. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And, there were a few months ago, people were sharing about this supposed case in an American court where the court had ruled that if someone has had a vaccination, which is some form of gene therapy, then it actually does change the legal status of the recipient to non-human. Now, I mean, of course, that sounds completely absurd. Of course, they're human. They're exactly the same as they were. They have the same memories, the same features. Everything about them is exactly the same. But as I said, in the system of law, it's based on the most detailed technicalities. And I can't help wondering whether in future, and this may be why they want to vaccinate us regularly, because perhaps the vaccine technology itself is progressing so quickly that every 6 months it's a new form of gene therapy. Maybe we will find one day that if you stand up in a courtroom, you're no longer being tried as a man, because technically, according to their own rules, you are not 100% human. You're only 99.999967% human. I don't know. I mean, that's the last kind of speculation I'll make on it tonight. Yeah, there are all kinds of rabbit holes we can go down, but the only ones that I'm certain about is that it's a form of cattle branding and that it justifies their digital surveillance system.
Absolutely. And that was something I wanted to bring in when you mentioned cattle branding. Just yesterday, I saw, I don't know how it came up, one of these things that just flashes up, you know, on social media. It was a photo of some people at one of these vaccination centres queuing around the car park to get vaccinated. And I remember it was a sort of miserable British day. You know, it had clearly been raining and, oh, my God. It just looked horrendous. You know, it's probably some rural town. Probably some nice place, you know.
It sounds almost as bad as the images that people have been sharing of people queuing to see the new Matrix film in the cinema. And I'm pretty sure it must be a Photoshop, but it says on the poster, it says in French, it says, or Spanish perhaps, it says, no green pass, no red pill. I mean, yeah, it's absurd.
That's amazing. Well, so I guess that would bring us to Agenda 21. So would you like to lay that out for people? We've alluded to different aspects of it already, but would you like to lay it out very clearly? COVID, I think we've probably spoken for 50 minutes now. We've been talking about COVID. It's a bit longer than we planned. Okay. What is it? What is Agenda 21? What will it comprise?
Okay, well, I mean, anyone who's you know, who's interested in a kind of longer discussion of this, I did a Morgcast, a podcast with Morgoth, where we discussed a bit more about the kind of details, the finer details of Agenda 21. And I would also implore anyone who really wants to understand it to watch the Mark Malone Millennial. And go and watch any some of the other videos he's done, because of all the people that I know still living, he's one of the most knowledgeable. I mean, we had Rosa Coiry, who died, I think it was earlier this year, unfortunately, who was very knowledgeable about it. But her videos are still about there. And most of what I know about it, I'm far from an expert, but most of what I know is I've learnt from people like them. Agenda 21... that's the short term for the agenda for the 21st century. It was a UN proposition which they put to a summit in 1992. So as I said, nearly 30 years ago. At the time, 179 countries signed on for it. So you know, and when people bring this up, you know, the kind of you know, the midwits, they say, oh, well, it's a non-binding agreement. But I mean, what does that mean when the tenets of it have been adhered to for the last 29 years? What it essentially is a complete transformation of the way that the planet is managed. Those who are behind it, this agenda, they want to inventory every last thing on the planet. I mean, we're talking every last man, woman, child, every last livestock, animal, every last forest, every last bit of agricultural land. They want it all inventoried. They want to have a record and of it. They want to survey it. It's also been signed on, just referencing some notes, because this isn't all, you know, buried in here, but by 1997, 70% of UK local authorities had signed on to the precepts of Agenda 21. So it's already, for the last at least 20, 25 years, has already been put into action. But it's not cool, you know, they don't come out and advertise it as Agenda 21. I mean, at the moment, it's being referred to as Agenda 2030 or the Great Reset or, you know, simply sustainability, because that word pretty much encompasses what it's all about. They're selling it to us as sustainability, i.e. they're saying the way that we're living now is unsustainable, so we need to find a way to make it sustainable. We need to promote more sustainable industries. We need to promote more sustainable habits among consumers. We need to promote more sustainable living practices and things like that. And, you know, you as a kind of, a layman, you'd hear that and think, well, yeah, that makes sense. I mean, yeah, you know, things do seem to be getting out of hand. There do seem to be perhaps too many people. There do seem to be too many cars on the road, too much pollution, things like that. And that's something that most of us can agree on. But again, it's all a smokescreen for what they really want to achieve. It's the way that they're going to remove property rights, because they're going to say, well, you own 30 acres and you're not doing anything with it, or you're managing that land, you're using that land inefficiently. So that's unsustainable. So therefore, we need to tax you more on that land, or we need to take some of that land away from you so that it can be used more sustainably. You know, that those are the kind of examples we're looking at. And I think it was the Daily Mail that recently ran an article saying that they private car ownership was going to be a thing of the past. So again, they're saying it's unsustainable for every person to have their own car, you know, and obviously they're selling it to us as a great thing. This is going to mean less traffic, less pollution, etc. But what it really amounts to is more control for them, more, because, you know, if they want to take land away, if they want to take ownership away, if we will own nothing and be happy, someone has to own it. You know, it's all very well saying nobody will own anything, but in practice, someone always owns it, and we know who that's going to be. It's going to be the people at the top of the pyramid, so to speak. So it's an incredible threat to the future of our customs, our traditions, our cultures, our ethnic groups, our children's future, everything. It's the biggest threat that I think humanity has ever faced, and it's being bought in off the back of this manufactured crisis.
Yeah. One thing that occurred to me the other day was, I was thinking there is a certain appeal to this idea, this vision of a world where there's not so much international travel. So this awful attitude that has been encouraged over the last 30 years, you know, the 2010s, it was just go around the world, shag women in every different country, just drink here, take drugs there, you know, piss on the architecture there, buy products there, just, it's just utter indulgence, you know, just everything's meaningless. And it's a global culture, you know, everything's the same everywhere you go. Well, if there wasn't so much international travel and everyone didn't have their own car and they were staying in their own town, their own village, whatever, then there's a certain appeal to that. It's like, oh, it'd be a return to tradition in a way. But really, it wouldn't be, because the culture would still be global. It would still be globalist crap that would be fed, like in the same way that OnlyFans is everywhere, Instagram is everywhere. You know, you might live in a village, but you know, your kids are still going to have Facebook. Well, not Facebook so much. They're still going to have TikTok. They're still going to have Instagram. They're still going to have. They're going to be on the same, getting the same crap that everyone else is getting everywhere else. So, and this would, I think, be a hyper version of that, where it would be global culture just drip fed through a fiber optic broadband connection to everyone. And so their own local customs and local festivals and all that would never be able to compete with that. And I think would be actively discouraged, actually. So people would be geographically confined, but that doesn't mean that it will be a return to tradition or a more wholesome way of living or a more warm, cozy way of living. It doesn't actually mean that at all. I think it could just, it could be the worst of everything. It'd be, you're geographically confined, and you don't have your own culture. Yeah, and in fact, your own culture is actively worked against.
Yeah, because they can't have anyone going off script. You can't have, you know, some village in India behaving and using resources differently to a village in Germany. You know the Yuletide celebration in some kind of rural village in Germany, where people have to drive from miles around to this central point to gather together to gather around the the Christmas tree, which is being lit up using so much electricity and things. What's sustainable about that in the eyes of these psychopaths who are trying to bring this new, you know, future to manifestation? There's nothing sustainable about that. It's a completely useless tradition. It's not good for us in any way, shape or form. And, you know, and I think the other thing is that, you know, because people like us, because we're not psychopaths, and because we're more innocent in the way we think about things, and because we like to think the best of things, we think, this could result in some kind of, Star Trek-esque utopia where, every town is perfectly clean and people aren't, abusing the natural environment and things like that. But that's so far from the mind of those who are, orchestrating this, that's not what they care about whatsoever. And you know, another aspect of this, you know, we've discussed the kind of more appealing aspects of what they're doing, I suppose, but there are other aspects of it which are to remove what they view as inequality. So they view inequality in the workplace and in society, and we're talking, you know, racial and sexual inequality. They view that as unsustainable. Why that's unsustainable, I'm not sure. And obviously, I'm not saying that people should be able to be abused or discriminated. You know, I mean, discriminated against in the sense that they're being abused or mistreated because of their racial or sexual background. But we know what inequality means to those who are currently kind of who are holding the reins of society.
Absolutely, it means that people care about things that limit capital, that limit the yeah. the flow of economic processes. Yeah. People care about things that complicate the picture for those above them. Whether it's culture, sexuality, religion, race, nationhood, whatever. I think these are things. And you mentioned this earlier. You said that this agenda is a threat to everything, and I think this is relevant to those people, the viewers of mine, people in the dissident right, what was the alt-right, which those people who, as I mentioned at the start, and I don't want to be condescending to them, and I definitely don't want to insult them. I just think that we do need to recognize the reality of the situation that we're in. And clearly, because otherwise we're just deluding ourselves. Those people who are concerned with race and ethnic identity, you know, I care about Britain. I do have an affinity with the British people. I do love various manifestations of British culture and British history, moments, things that you could pluck out of the historical continuum mean a great deal to me because they're what I've grown up with. That has not changed. And I doubt that I will ever be able to think of an English garden on a rainy day in autumn and not feel tremendous affinity for that. And like tremendous wonder and fascination and mystery in that. That I don't think is ever going to change, right? I want to be clear about that. However, we are now in a new age, and we need to prioritize the things that deserve to be prioritized. And so if you want to get back to that garden in autumn on the rainy day, you have to deal with the battles, the wars that are in front of you.
Exactly. Yeah. It's the nation state itself is unsustainable, according to Agenda 21. That, you know, so, you know, people are talking about how this is some kind of distraction from nationalism or traditionalism or any of the other battles that have been fought over the last however many decades. People talk about, you know, certain among us talk about how this is somehow a distraction from those things. But I mean, that's the exact opposite of what's going on. It's not a distraction from those things. It is the driving force for those things. It's just that it's become entirely apparent now. It was for the last couple of decades, it's been working in the background to destroy all of these things, but now it's out in the open. They're using this COVID fueled crisis as the battering ram to get all of this stuff through. And you know, I mean, what are we to do? Ignore that battering ram and try to kind of, you know, piece together what's you know, still there on the sidelines. I do very much agree with what Philosophercat said in your stream with her. I mean, you know, none of us can articulate things perfectly. I'm not going to criticize the way that she put it because I think she articulated it well. What's going on now is so much more important than any of the other battles. And that's not to say that the sentiment behind those is unimportant or should be relinquished. Not at all. But it's that we stand absolutely no chance of winning those battles unless we win this bigger battle, which is now facing us.
Absolutely. And this is the thing I wanted you to go into. You said that all of these things are threatened. Can you talk about, and I think to illustrate this for people who might not understand, they might not have thought about this before, dissidents and the digital ID and digital currency. Now, you've written Telegram posts about this. Everyone should subscribe to the Fergan Telegram channel, by the way, and it's linked below, because Dan writes very interesting and concise. Not a lot of people master the art of being concise.
I make a real point of that. I really do, because there are so many channels out there, and they write these long essays as though it's a like a blog website. So I really try to be as concise as I can.
It's good. And one of them, or several of them, have been about the digital ID and the implications of, you know, we've talked about that already, but also digital currency. Because some people, I think, have the idea that, okay, it's digital ID, but it doesn't need to affect my life that much. But digital currency really does, because, go into it, please.
Yeah, well, I mean, when we say digital currency, I mean, we could say, well, our currency is already digital. You know, we pay with a credit or a debit card, most people. You know, cash is already on its way out. Which, you know, a lot of people kind of, you know, lament the fact that cash is on its way out. But, you know, I don't hold any kind of like fondness for cash. It's still fiat currency. It's still a tool of our enemy, as far as I'm concerned. But I suppose it's a step back, from this kind of hellish dystopia that we're facing. But anyway, what we're talking about when we say digital currency, what we're really talking about is programmable currency, because that's what blockchain, CBDCs, central bank digital currencies, you know, what most people would refer to as crypto, is programmable. The way that the blockchain works is that the whole blockchain is has integrity, or none of it has integrity. So you can't corrupt a small part of it. Like you could take, you know, a £10 note and rip it in half, you know, or a £10 note and you spend it, you know, give it to someone who would be deemed by the state to be a criminal. With the blockchain, you can't do that, because the entire blockchain knows what's happening on the entire blockchain at all times. And if the establishment is in control, if the central bank, who is obviously in cahoots with the UK government, if they have control over that programmable currency and they are able to monitor what happens across the entire blockchain, they're able to use smart contracts to automatically program how certain units of that currency are spent, where they're spent, how quickly they're spent, then quite quickly we can see that if you are someone who is deemed to be questionable, then perhaps you might be given a smaller portion of it. And this is why you can't really talk about digital currency without talking about UBI, universal basic income, because if people are still able to use a digital currency which they earn for themselves, which they're not dependent on the state for, then it doesn't really matter how restricted their transactions are, because they can just earn more. But if you're jobless and you're receiving just enough UBI per month to pay your bills, your, you know, extremely vital things like your Netflix subscription, your Amazon Prime subscription, stuff like that, if you're receiving just enough money for that, and then all of a sudden you are found to be liaising with someone deemed persona non grata, then you might find that your next month's UBI is docked by 10%. I mean, I know I'm talking real kind of worst case scenario, full dystopia here, but the point is that this is what digital currency enables. This is where it could lead, and this is where I believe they want to take it. So it may be that, you know, it's decided that for sustainability reasons, as part of Agenda 21, you shouldn't be more than 5 miles from your home. So if you drive 10 miles to visit someone and you try to fill up at a petrol station, your digital transaction will be denied because you're too far away from where you should be. Or if you try to order something on the internet which is deemed an unsustainable purchase, you know, perhaps you're an American who tries to buy some ammunition or something like that, or you try to buy some, heirloom seeds. That's deemed unsustainable because you shouldn't be growing your own food because that's grown inefficiently. You should be buying food from here where it's grown more efficiently. You know, all of this is possible. I'm not saying that this is going to happen within the next year or even the next 5 years, but it's where it could lead.
Well, imagine if unsustainable became the new hate, because things that are now just unfashionable are deemed hate.
Mm.
So we've got hate speech and all sorts of things. You know, hate speech started off being racism. That was about it, really. The homophobia, I guess. But it's now transphobia, Islamophobia, and also weird things that you wouldn't think they would ever do this, but things like opposition to globalization is now called hate speech.
Yeah.
Even
opposition to central bank usury, yeah.
Exactly. And also opposition to the COVID agenda has been described as hate speech.
Yeah.
So imagine if unsustainable, and so the category of hate speech is a sort of magic category, not only because it can be stretched to contain whatever they want, but also because once something is in that category, it becomes sort of evil. If you are guilty of hate speech, then you can legitimately be banned from public platforms. You can be ejected from the public space, as has happened to me, and I'm not going to go on about it, but it's happened to many people, and some people have had it a lot worse than I have, because of the magic nature of the category of hate speech. It's not like any other. And indeed, you'll get people saying hate speech is not free speech. It's different. It's a separate thing. And now imagine if unsustainable became a similar magic category where it then enables, it legitimates reducing people's rights in the same way that hate speech legitimates reducing people's rights and punishing them for making certain choices.
Yeah, and if you find one day that your digital UBI has been reduced so that you can't pay your bills, and you proclaim complain, I should say, that it's a human right for me to be able to pay my bills, and then the response then will be, well, you forfeited your human rights when you associated with this person or tried to buy this unsustainable product or tried to travel outside of your containment zone. You know, that's the thing with this whole COVID thing, is redefining language and redefining people's values and expectations of what fundamental rights are. And I think that's only going to get worse.
Yeah, I agree. I think the key thing here to understand is the magicness of the category of hate speech, because once you grasp that it enables things to happen that wouldn't otherwise be conceivable. The same thing could happen with if it's a moral goal, a political goal, a cultural, social goal, that everything be sustainable, then anything that is unsustainable by definition, by necessity, has to be worked against. Anyone who works against any corporation that works to thwart it is justified in doing so. It becomes it becomes a moral imperative that they stop you. So they might not even stop you, but they'll punish you for it by, well, okay, we're going to take 5% off your balance. to encourage you to do the right thing in future. Or you won't be able to take out to use money for the next 24 hours. Yeah. And eventually, it would just need to be little things like that. Eventually, people would really start to despair. And I think they would just start to give up on the idea of doing anything that was that went against the sustainability agenda.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, and also, you know, kind of coming back from the new economic model that they're proposing, you know, merely the prospect of vaccine or digital IDs to get into certain venues or to cross borders or to use certain services, that alone makes any form of dissident activism extremely difficult. And, you know, that they can effectively control who we meet up with, where, when we meet up with people, what we do when we've met up with them, what we say online. These are all things that they will be able to control, because censorship is another sustainable goal. You know, the right for people not to be offended, because, you know,
safety, hate,
yeah, absolutely. Safety is sustainable, and you know, harming people's safety is not, you know.
So I mean, a part of this would be that if you've done something that if you're part of a group or part of an organ, or you've been to a certain conference, then you have, by doing so, you have you're working against the premises
the
of
common
your society,
good.
The common good, exactly. Yeah. Now, I think what a lot of people would say at this point is, yeah, sure, they could try this, but the courts would intervene. Now, and here's, I think this is the perhaps the scariest part of it. Look at how Antifa get away with anything. I mean, they get away with unbelievable behavior. Look at the incredible contrast between the treatment, and we're going to go over to America for this comparison, the incredible difference between how James Alex Fields was treated 4 centuries in prison next to what happened in Waukesha, where the guy's just completely fallen off the radar. No one's talking about it. And there was one news story about how he feels he's being victimized and demonized. And other than that, no one's talking about it. That is absolutely astounding. And of course, Derek Chauvin as well. Now, the media's treatment of a news story enables the courts to behave in certain ways, which enables corporations and governments to behave in certain ways. Now, when I got banned from Instagram, I didn't really care about it. It was whatever. But I did look into, well, could I protest this? Now, first of all, they say, you have violated our terms. And in such cases, there is no possibility for appeal. Now, that's their end user license agreement. Presumably, at some point, I agreed to that. I didn't read the copious, the voluminous document. So I, like no one else does either. So at some point, I probably agreed to that. Whatever. And I, of course, they'll also rely on that. They'll rely on the human frailty that people don't have the time to read these terms and conditions, so that they unwittingly agree to ridiculous conditions. But anyway, so we'll skip over that. There's no possibility to appeal it, but I could take them to court. I could take Instagram, the Facebook corporation, to court. However, that corporation is domiciled for European purposes, at least. It's domiciled in Ireland, so it would be an Irish court that that examined the case. Now, big tech is famously in control of Ireland. It has tremendous influence over the culture in Ireland and the government of Ireland, and almost certainly thereby the legal system of Ireland. So in other words, you can take Instagram to court, but only within a court system that they have shaped to get the laws that they want, to get the legal precedents that they want. So that so that basically they'll get their way. If you do have the money and the patience and the time and the will to go through a court case with a global corporation, they'll win anyway. Because so let's say with the sustainability agenda and your bank decides to deactivate whatever it is, limit your spending for the next 3 days because you attended a certain conference. You're going to take them to court? What are you going to do about it? You're going to say they're violating my human rights. This is terrible. Well, the media are going to be against you. The media are going to be applauding the bank for doing this to you. So the government aren't going to go against the media, and they're in agreement with them anyway. And the court system, you could take the bank to court. Do you have the money for that? No, because you're on UBI. But let's assume that you do somehow get the money. Well, then it's all rigged anyway. So this is the point. Once they can do this, they can effectively control your lifestyle and thereby what you do and the causes and groups that you can support. Because after all, everyone has to have a life. They have to have they don't have to have a family, but they might want to have a family. They might want to have this or that hobby, whatever it is. All of that could be endangered, jeopardized by the decision to support certain political groups or to attend certain conferences or whatever. So this is why dissidents should take this extremely seriously. It's already difficult enough with the threat from Antifa to attend certain conferences. And as I said, they get away with it. Antifa never get punished for what they do. Imagine how much more difficult it could be if your bank could simply quietly punish you for this, because you're going against the sustainability agenda and the safety on the IRL safety agenda.
Yeah, and for communitarian reasons, those objectives now supersede the national law. The national constitution in America, or the Bill of Rights or whatever in England. This is what they're trying to do. They're trying to supplant our previous systems of law fair process with this new system of, well, the technocrats have already determined what is acceptable behavior and what is good for the group. What is, in their communitarian model, they've already determined that it's already programmed into the blockchain. So no decision needs to be made anymore. There doesn't even need to be a court hearing because you have quite clearly violated this goal of sustainability. You've affronted this aspect of inequality or whatever, and so it's automatically there. It's all your judgment is already made, and probably by an algorithm on the other side of the world. And they'll say, well, you still have the right to appeal this. But as you just described, it's all wrapped up in these, hundreds of layers of bureaucracy, and it's a task just to speak to a human or receive a letter from a human anymore. So it becomes impossible at that point, even though technically they can say, well, you still have the ability to appeal. In practice, it becomes impossible.
Yeah, exactly. And there won't be the human rights organizations to clear a path through that, all of that bureaucracy, all those individual cases, because the human rights organizations, they've been silent on COVID.
And so they're completely signed up to Agenda 21. Absolutely. Yeah.
So I've just realized the time, and I'm supposed to start with the next guest in 10 minutes, Vico Hesler, who's similar kind of topic to this. But anyway, okay. I don't want to paint it as I don't want to depress people. I don't want to blackpill them. So let's end with solutions, aspirations, and opportunities, because but just to underline what we went into there, this is why dissidents should take it seriously. The whole COVID, Great Reset, this is why it matters more than the stuff we were talking about 4 years ago, because they are taking away your freedom to even pursue those topics, to even learn about them. So, okay, let's move on to the final thing.
Yeah, well, I can imagine, you know, some people out there are listening and thinking, well, it's never going to go that far. You know, what you're describing there is a really extreme example of what could happen, and it's not going to go that far. But I just think that's incredibly naive at this point. After what's happened the last 20 months, to think that your enemy wouldn't use every single tool at their disposal.
Absolutely. And as I say, this happened to me with Instagram in whenever it was, a few months ago, April or something. And again, with Twitter, the emails from them are signed Twitter. It's not an individual. I've no idea who it was, even if it was a human being who read them, my appeals. So you're up against the whole thing. So it's already real within that sphere. And if we do that to freedom of speech, why wouldn't we do it to freedom of action?
I can be very brief on this last point, really, with solutions. To be honest, I think that the Woodlander represents, as far as I'm concerned, he represents the solutions, because we need to find ways to disentangle ourselves from those layers of bureaucracy that we just described. We need to find ways to out of all of these contracts and leases and policies and dependencies that we have on the current system, because the more dependent and the more wrapped up we are in that, the more, you know, as I say, the more policies and leases and contracts and things that we have with the system, the more pitfalls there are going to be for us if we fall out of line. So someone like the Woodlander, what he's done in creating this self-sufficient, largely self-sufficient lifestyle where he's not really dependent on the system in any way now, he could survive if tomorrow the system decided to tell him that his associations with someone are such that they want to end his electricity.
Because he appeared supply. On Millennial, so, you know, no electricity then, for him.
No problem. You know, he's good. So I think that's it. I think we need to learn to we need to relearn to love the really simple things in life. I think our lives have become too complex, and we just need to learn to build connections with people, just cherish relationships, and for those relationships to be enough of a joy in our lives without, you know, the kind of all of the subscriptions we've got to Netflix and all of this kind of stuff. We just need to go back to a more simple way of life, I believe, that's more independent of the system. Without going into great depth, I really think that that's basically the long and short of it. We need to detach from the system as much as we can. That's easier said than done, especially if you have a job, if you're employed and you depend on that for your income. But at least start to think about how you could work towards a lesser dependency on the system. Even if it's only ends up with you being 10% less dependent on the system, that's still a huge accomplishment. Someone like the Woodlander might be like 90% independent of the system. So it's not an all or nothing thing. I just think that all of us need to try and work in whatever way we can to become more independent of it, and that's in a nutshell, I think that that's the best solution that we can look to.
This is something that will develop, and there will be more to be said about this in the future, because obviously we need to be able to offer people practical advice about this if we're going to blackpill them about the current situation. To some extent, it's not that there's a moral duty then to give them advice on how to solve it, but I personally feel I should.
I really do think that, because, you know, you watch people like Neil Oliver, who, you know, lots of people are kind of holding up as this, you know, this great kind of example of someone from almost within the establishment who's now speaking against it. And hats off to him. He does that in a very good way, but and, you know, I'll admit I've not watched him that closely, but I've never seen him offer a solution. He talks about not complying, but I don't think that's enough of a solution, because that's just treading water, so to speak. And I agree with you. I think that if we are going to kind of present these very dystopic visions of what could happen, we also need to do our very best. And I try to do this with my channel because, you know, God knows there are enough channels out there who are merely sharing doom and gloom. And it's much easier to do that than to try and propose solutions. But we do need to make a real effort to do that.
Yeah, absolutely. It's very easy to just share black pill stuff. And, you know, there are some people who do that, and I disapprove of it, because I think it's irresponsible to just constantly be drowning people in reasons to be miserable. And I hope this is one of the reasons with millennial this year.
Yeah, this is one of the reasons for CryptoNats, for Crypto for Nationalists, which I set up in August 2020. You know, that was an attempt to try and offer some kind of solution to people. And I think it served a lot of people well. So, it's just one small thing that hopefully contributes to it. And hopefully everyone is kind of taking these ideas and running with them.
I hope so. I mean, I'm going to be having several people on this year to talk, two people to talk about crypto. Ask you if you wanted to do one as well, but we decided against it. But it is something that, absolutely. I still say, as I said last year, I think that everyone should be getting into crypto. There's just, you're crazy not to. If you can, then you should. For all the reasons that, you know, we've been going for an hour and a half now, it's 90 minutes of reasons why you should be getting into crypto.
Okay, so we can wrap it up if you like, because I don't know if there are any questions, but I know you've got someone lined up to come soon. So
let's do the questions and then we'll wrap it up, because I don't want to let people down with the questions. Hold on a second. Okay. Great convo. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Community building is key. If I can presume, many of us, like myself, are in virtually a perpetual state of isolation. It's honestly debilitating. What recommendations can you give me to spiritually, mentally, and physically resist the deleterious effects of isolation? Well, get out of the house and exercise. I'm not very physically fit just now, but at various points I have, like when I've been really depressed, exercise has been unbelievably helpful. It really is a very good idea, but definitely just get out of the house and just chat to people. Don't worry about how you'll come across to them, because they don't really care. It doesn't matter.
None of that matters anymore. I mean, you know, and also I would say, you know, if you are really alone, that is a difficult position to be in. I mean, I'm very, very fortunate to have a wife and good friends who are very much on the same wavelength. What I would do if I were in your position, if you go to a shop, a supermarket or something, and you're not wearing a mask, which I would hope you don't do because it's so easy not to, and you see someone else who's not wearing a mask and perhaps they smile to you, why not strike up a conversation with them? You know, I know not all of us are that outgoing, but if you did, you would probably find an ally there. You could perhaps exchange numbers. You could perhaps, you know, communicate, even if it's just over text message or something for a while. There are also initiative called, I think it's called Freedom Hubs or something like that. I can't quite remember the name, but I contacted them and they've got networks. They've got hubs all over the country, all over the UK and elsewhere, I believe, where you contact the central person of that hub. And they'll put you in touch with others. And there are usually telegrams for groups for each of these so that you can get to know other people in your general area who think like you do. And, you know, they may not hold all of the same views that you do, but generally speaking, on the COVID issue, they will be completely in step with you.
Well, maybe you could link Freedom Hubs from your Telegram channel. Find it. So people should go and subscribe to the Fergan on Telegram. And if you're not on Telegram, get onto Telegram as soon as you can.
It's the place to be.
Yeah.
For now.
Okay. Look up Dr. This is from Gallic Nord. Look up Dr. Robert Malone. He invented the mRNA technology that's used in these JAGs, and he himself has come out against all of this. Yeah. I feel his position is that his technology is being seriously misused by Big Pharma and others. His Telegram channel is RW Malone MD. if that would interest you or others. Thank you very much. Mm-hmm. My first millennial and really enjoying it. Great conversations today, so I thought you deserved a tip for your efforts. Merry Christmas. Well, thank you, JD. I'm glad you're enjoying it, and thank you for the tip. Let me see if there are any others. The digital currency... Oh, hold on a second. Merry Christmas, Woz. Physical health of our community should be one of the top priorities, as this makes us more physically able for worst-case scenarios, while increasing confidence when dealing with normies. They respect fit people. The more physically fit I've become, the more they listen to me. That's interesting. That doesn't surprise me, actually. I think it's an instinctual thing. Mm-hmm. Because you know, when you see someone who's overweight and they're trying to tell you how about the state of the world, instinctually, you're doubting them. You're doubting because you can see and they can't take control care of themselves.
And if they try and tell you that you're endangering them by not wearing a mask or getting the jab, then your very presence disproves that.
There have been several memes about that. It's quite amusing. Monty Fontaine says, the digital currency will also be used by the nudge departments, so we'll have our behaviour influenced without even knowing it. Absolutely. I didn't mention the nudge stuff earlier on, but yeah, that's crucial to all of this.
That's something you talked about with UK Column, wasn't it, I believe?
Yeah. And I wanted to go more into the behavioural insights team but to talk more about that, but it didn't happen. Okay. Fergan, there's a video on YouTube that depicts exactly what you described about a social credit used for transactions executed via smart contracts.
Yeah.
It's meant to be a high-production humorous video, but it's very real what you see. Leonardo of Biz on YouTube. It's dark humour, but you may enjoy it.
Yeah, no, I've seen that. That's the animated one where there's a... Yeah, it starts with a guy waking up in his pod, going to work, and there's like a glass cubicle that he's in, and his superior is above him, and he says that the pod is too small, and so he gets points deducted through a smart contract. Yeah, so it's a really great little animation, that, which is humorous but also harrowing.
I remember a similar sort of thing. It reminded me of there was a program in the mid 2000s, you might remember it, what the hell was it called? Monkey Dust? Something like that. There was an anime. It was like dark, very dark humor. Let me just see if I'm remembering this correctly. Yeah, Monkey Dust. Yeah.
Never heard of it.
2004 sort of thing, and it was a similar visual style, and it was similarly fucking depressing, but it was also very funny. Yeah. Strangely enough. Anyway, okay, let's leave it at that. I think this has been an excellent stream. I'm confident about this one.
Really enjoyed it. No, thank you for having me.
Yeah, I think many people will have enjoyed this and benefited from it, hopefully. All right, great. Dan from the Fargan, thank you for appearing on Millennial 2021.
Yeah, good Yule, everyone.
Okay, I'll be back very shortly with Vico Hesler, and I'll see you then. Bye-bye for now.
Millennial Woz has created many things, and this is your chance to own one of them. A unique piece of work handcrafted by the Vile Vlogger to commemorate Millennial 2021. 100 hours of highly skilled labour went into producing this animated vector graphic, which can be magnified to any size. In the iconic Millennial Woz font, it glistens and responds to your touch. And at the centre of it all, a figure representative of 2021, the White Stag, symbolising endurance, discovery, and rejuvenation. This one-of-a-kind creation is up for sale as an NFT. Follow the link below, and it can be yours forever. This is your only chance.